Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis, Chuck Thurston, and Marvin Gowan. Hi, you guys.
Hi,
Marvin,
folks.
Hi.
Hey.
We're all here again. Yay. I love it.
Getting the band back together.
Yeah, getting the band back together. We'll be off next week. And we'll be off at the end of the month, the last weekend of the month, as Andre and I are both on a trip, but we'll be back every chance we get. And I just wanted to say that, you know, that song is based, that we play every week, is based on a poem by Rabia, the Sufi poet. And the singer is Annie Zonneveld. She was born in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. She's a Malaysian-American singer, songwriter, activist, and writer based in Los Angeles. She's also a Muslim imam, as I recall. She's released 3 original albums, produced music for other artists, and participated in writing Grammy-winning songs. And in fact, she's the first Malaysian person to have won a Grammy. So, thank you, Ani, for letting us use your song. It's such a beautiful song, and we really love it. And, you know, as an aside, you guys, my grandson is at a debate today with his debate class, and he's reading poems by Rabia. So I was telling him that our theme song is just one such poem. And I sent it to him. He thought that was pretty cool. He's going to be going to the Parliament of the World's Religions with me. Deeply, deeply interested in it. Yeah.
Excellent.
And,
that's great.
Yeah. I'm so excited about that. It's a bit of a graduation present. He graduates this year, and he starts at Northwestern next year. He got a
in
full
Chicago.
Scholarship there. Yeah. And so in August, we're going to be at the Parliament of the World's Religions, me and my precious Andy. Andre probably remembers the time when we were doing a worship service and Andy was just a little squirt and he got up on stage with me. He's such a joy in my life, and I'm so proud of him. So that's kind of neat to be able to share this kind of thing with him. It's awesome, actually.
Yeah. What's he going to be studying at Northwestern? Does he know yet?
I think international, or, you know, interestingly, the last I heard, it was philosophy and economics.
Oh, no.
I told him, philosophy will help you no matter what you do in life. You know, it will always be of value, I think. So, anyway, that's just a little aside on our wonderful theme song, a poem by Rabia, In My Soul, as put to music and sung by Annie Zonneveld. So much thanks to her. And also we should do a shout out to the fellowship who sponsors our show and to Gary Tong who created our logo. Very much appreciate the way your Rancher Book readers work together on these kinds of projects and endeavors. It really is exciting and wonderful. And, you know, the fellowship just put up, just so everyone knows, the fellowship just put up a page on their website, and we are featured on that page. And that's if you go to the main site, which is www.yourrancherbook.org, and on the main menu bar under our programs, you'll find the Cosmic Citizen. We have our own page now. So that's great, too.
Oh, that's good news.
Yeah. After 16 years, we're still around and still plugging away.
That's great.
It's like people tell me, you know, at the booths many times as I've worked outreach booths, and I tell them that I've been reading this book for almost, you know, for over 40 years or whatever. You know, you're still reading it. You haven't finished it yet? It's like, no. I'm hoping to take it with me. You know, they say you can't take it with you, but I'm praying that there's an equivalent on Mansonia.
I'm sure there will be. In fact, I think it probably comprises the initial course of orientation. At least it's part of it for lots of folks who come there from this world and from other worlds, but especially from this world. That's what I would think. Seems like very grounded. Yeah.
Yeah, probably be a textbook.
Your rancher
ascenders.
Well, yeah, I think that would be true, Chuck, because they say in one spot that they don't always reveal this much information to planets that haven't gotten that far in their evolution.
Right.
I don't recall the exact quote, unfortunately, but I do remember that they say it's rather unprecedented.
Hmm. The scope of what's revealed in the Rancher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the different levels, you know, the high levels of the revelation.
Well, I think it's partly because we've had a pistole sun. So technically we're sort of in a post-pistole sun age, even though the planet is still, like, culturally and civilizationally struggling to get out of some of the earlier epochs, shall we say. But spiritually, Jesus, you know, gave us this gift of insight that goes all the way into eternity in the absolute. You know, they talk about the faith of Jesus. There's really no limit to where that reaches. So it makes sense, I guess, they would be stretching our minds as much as we're capable of engaging, you know, since we have the desire for that, it's there. It's remarkable, you know, what some of the papers do, you know, that are they're famously sort of incomprehensible. But if you dig with it, you know, if you really dig into it, you begin to get a conceptual, you know, sort of architecture built in your mind that can receive and understand even many of those teachings. So it's quite a thing, really. I mean, just how stress it is, how far away it is from current culture that we live in, we live with every day. But I mean, parts of it, not all of it, but parts of it. But that's good.
Yeah.
Because we can kind of carry that sense of reality around with us, you know, and that can be a kind of a positive influence, I think.
Well, we refer to these teachings so often in life. I know you guys do,
mm-hmm.
too.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's really amazing, you know, to think about not having it to refer to.
Oh, boy. I don't even want to go there.
I mean, let's not even go there. That would not be good.
Maybe we didn't have. Anyway.
I'm sure there's an equivalent for us.
Makes me wonder about this, the Rancho Cucamonga being an experiment on many levels. Like while you guys were talking, it just occurred to me, you know, that if at some future point, maybe sooner or later, it's hard to tell, there is another incarnation of a divine being, you know, as an next revelatory bestowal, a teacher son or the you know, magisterial son is what would come next after bestowal. They speculate a lot about who might come back in this very unusual situation on this very unusual planet. But I wonder whether a celestial being could actually use the text as a basic primer for a spiritual mission. You know, so it could be, I wonder if they're not experimenting with it and may be continuing to experiment with it and have plans for it that we just don't, we can only guess at.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right about
just because it is such an unusual body of information.
I
think they're learning a lot about what can be done with it and its limitations, you know.
Yeah. Well, someday we have a magisterial son. It'll probably be the sort of the main textbook for that, too.
You would think so, yeah.
Well, I can't imagine how people would make any sense of what was going on without that understanding, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I mean, that makes sense to me, for sure.
Yeah, or Melchizedek, you know, Machiavelli.
I know, so many.
As planetary prince, planetary prince. It seems like that's going to change everything, too. I don't know. It's hard to imagine. He's kind of holding off for now. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think, but in long lines of what you're saying, Marvin, I think maybe they're just sort of giving it some time on its own to see what it does. To see if it's taken up and becomes an influence. In a larger way over time.
Yeah. It's anybody's guess, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm sure they are learning a lot, you know. I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
You know, always from all of us, from this planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but
we are
experimental,
after all.
Yeah. I mean, it could be that widespread acceptance of the Rancho book is a necessary condition for the arrival of some, you know, new divine son, whether it be Machiavelli or magisterial son. You know, they're probably not going to attempt that until there's at least some conceptual capacity for recognizing the reality of such a being. You know, in some way
that's
to comprehend what that would even be about. You know, it's like Van and Amadon. They taught, they coached and taught, you know, people that helped them build the garden, promising, this is perfect. This, you know, divine pair of beings are going to show up here pretty soon. We better get a place ready. But they had a concept of it. And so they prepared the people for the arrival of Adam and Eve. Even though they were still, like, blown away, they could at least have some conceptual frame for understanding what was happening. And, you know, most of that kind of a higher kind of understanding has really been lost. You know, the understanding of the true nature of these divine beings that can show up from time to time. I mean, you know, Jesus, you know, Dusty Macaventa, you know, we've had not been without that in the past, so we can probably assume it's going to happen again. But maybe they're wanting us to, I mean, knowing what we know just from the historical knowledge of Jesus, you know, even though it's distorted and partial, we captured it in the Bible. Even that, though, provides a foundation for the Urantia book, I think, in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Urantia book has helped all of us to have a better understanding of Jesus. At least for me, I can speak for myself, I guess. After reading studying the Urantia book, now I can say, oh, that's who this guy in the Bible is. And now I can sort of understand it in a much fuller and complete way, and I'm able to sift through it, you know, and say, okay, well, that's just something they put in there. It's not quite right. But there is a lot, even in the Bible, that's really good and very true. So
it builds on all those themes, really.
Yeah.
It builds on all those, you know, it builds on the concept of angels. It builds on the concept of course, of God, and that's where we are engaged in this study, the first five papers. It reveals God's nature and his true and loving nature, which, other teachings make it sound cliche, but the Urantia book brings it home. And it builds on the concepts of Adam and Eve and our religious, our heritage, our spiritual heritage. And, it's just so many of the themes that it builds on are themes that were prevalent in Judeo-Christianity, and of course it provides a superior philosophy.
Yeah. And it does all that in modern language.
And in modern language, yes.
It's a huge, huge deal, because
even in a language that in a way intellectually resonates at such a high level that it makes it very difficult to understand what they're saying at times, right? And, not everybody is, intellectually endowed the same way. And I often tell people I'm a spiritual and philosophical thinker, but I'm not a scientist. I admire science, and I admire scientists, and I love being in study groups with people who think like that, because I learn so much from them. You know, it's part of why I love being in this group with you guys. But I think it speaks to those three mindsets. I really do. And for every page I ever read of the Urantia book, for the things that went over my head, something else went in my heart. It seems to me like they're explaining it often.
That's a nice way of putting it. That's a great way of putting it. Paul. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, I have told many, many people, when I'm introducing the book, look, don't let, if you read something that you don't understand, just keep going. Because for everything, and then I share that experience, for those paragraphs or statements that went over my head, something else went right in my heart, and I didn't want to miss those for anything. I cherish those, and they're in every section, on every page.
The little nuggets they throw in.
Those
right
nuggets.
In the middle of some of the most intense conceptual stuff. I'll just throw in a little thing there.
I'll keep going with that. Wow, that felt good. And, I told somebody recently, I stopped underlining my book because I realized that over the years I would have underlined everything.
Underlined the whole thing.
But I wish that, because when we all, and Marvin, you probably remember this, and Andre and Chuck too, when we first started reading, everybody was underlining. All underlining. used to keep a ruler in my book so that I could do a nice, neat underline. And a lot of people did highlighters and stuff. You know, with the thin paper, they do bleed through, and that was a problem somewhat. But I do wish now that I had kept underlining and that I had dated those underlines. You know what I mean? That I had put a little date in the margin so that I would say now when I read it again, oh, that jumped out to me at 21. You know? That, I think, would be very, would be invaluable just to know that. But
kind of a history there.
Yeah, kind of a, it helps you. You know, I think I've told you guys I'm putting all of my poetry into a digital format. One of the things I wanted to do upon retirement has always been that. I have this big binder full of it.
Wow.
And as I, and oftentimes when something inspires me, I will jot it down. I'll write it down. I have to capture it in the moment because if I don't, it won't be there. It'll go away for some strange reason. Maybe you guys experience
that
too.
No, I know that feeling. Yeah.
I've heard people get up in the middle of the night and write things down when it comes to them because they'll forget it. Yeah.
Absolutely,
But I've been putting that all as I am working still, but not such an intense job that takes up a full 9 hours of my every day. And so I've been, as I can, putting those, you know, in a format and putting them in a Word document. And as I enter them in, I think, oh, yeah, I remember when I wrote that. I was a young mom, you know, and I reflect on where I was mentally when I wrote that poem. And it's cathartic for me to do that. It's really amazing. And I'm sure people who have journaled for years and years find the same thing when they go back and reread their journals and realize, oh, I wrote that when I was 25. Wow, I was going through some stuff right then. Or, you know, whatever it is. I just think it's really cool. It's been a great exercise for me. And
connecting up pieces of our history.
Yeah. Do you guys find that you, as the older you get, the more you reflect on your history, personal history?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Me too.
Well, and it's one of the things the Revelation does, you know, is it goes back into historic times and times that are pre-recorded history and gives us all of this information that puts it in context. It helps us to understand where we are currently in the historical flow. So I think it's true for the race as it is for the individual, in a sense, to have those touchstones of key points where key events happened that were impactful.
Right. You remember where you were at the time or what was going on, but you don't always remember what you were thinking at that time or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a journal really helps with that. It's interesting. You probably have told lots of people to journal, huh, Marvin?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the tools, you know. It's a good tool for folks, to reflect and deepen in that way.
Putting things into words. Well, it's like you were saying earlier, Paul, being able to put feelings into words. Because sometimes feelings are not just human emotions of, you know, regret and doubt and all that stuff. But sometimes you have feelings of possibility. And, you know, the sort of the higher types of, you know, like even before finding the Rancher book, I'm sure we could all look back and leading up to discovering it, we were feeling urges, you know, God-seeking urges. I mean, I just was looking back at the previous section in this paper, and they list those three phenomena occur in the human mind as a result of the presence of the adjuster. And there's the intellectual capacity for God knowing, God consciousness, to the spiritual urge to find God, God seeking, and then the personality craving to be like God, the wholehearted desire to do the Father's will. And I think probably, again, to speak for myself, that feelings, at least sort of prototypes of those feelings, you might say, they're certainly rising up in me, and that's what sort of got me to the Answer book. So it's interesting to look back and then now with this lens to see that that was probably a Jester influence that aroused those phenomena in my mind, which, you know, I didn't have any way of understanding at the time, but I could feel those urges. You know, there's more going on here. And what's this is about God. It's God, you know, what is that? You know, all those kind of things where you want a better understanding. You know, there's not, you've talked about that a lot too, Paul, about not being satisfied with the concept of God that you were offered from your sort of evolutionary circumstances. Might be better than nothing, you know, at least raises the question. But wanting something more, wanting something like that's not enough. I want to know more. And it's interesting to read there in that section, the three urges come from the adjuster. So
the three urges, and they're with you always. I mean, I'll share with you one of the poems I wrote, and this was upon finding the Urantia book. And it's just called, it's short, it's called I Prayed. I prayed in silent agony for sweeter words of faith. My prayers, like swift messengers, went gliding into space. Questions I pondered endlessly as if to drive me mad. Why could I not accept as truth religious teachings I had had? I ached to know the ring of truth, and truth I longed to hear, to say, oh yes, it must be so, and know that God is near. Bless you, Jesus, mentor of mine, for in my darkness you came. A promise made of purest light, when this you did proclaim. Seek, and you will find. Ask, and you will be answered. Knock, and the door shall be opened unto you.
That's great.
That was pretty cathartic to read that again.
Lovely, Paul. Yeah, it's interesting to go back, to that moment, those moments, you know, in our lives when shortly after finding the revelation and what began to happen in our minds and in our hearts and in our lives. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to have a poetic record of that, Paula. That's lovely.
Wow, this is great. I didn't actually date them specifically. I wish I had. Again, I wish I had. I'm kind of zen about stuff that way, you know. But I do remember that was in absolute gratitude for finding that.
Yeah, you feel it. You feel it through the words.
Yeah. So, Andre, just so you know, Andre is still having the same phone issue that he's been having. We were talking about a little bit, and he said it's not much he can do about it. His phone just shuts down, and he's researched it, and I guess it's just the model or whatever. They think it's an internal mechanism problem. It's not a setting. And so, it's not a problem for us unless – like that one day, that couple weeks ago when the program just ended abruptly at the end. that's just the way it was. It was like, okay, you're out of here. Your time is up.
Yes.
And it doesn't always do that, but, Andre gets back on every time. The phone literally shuts down and he has to open it and then, re-enter the...
Would they give you a replacement device, Andre? I wonder.
He's not on right now. Here he is. He's back. Hi, Andre. I was just explaining some of the challenges you're experiencing with your phone. But I also am experiencing challenges lately with the chat board. I don't know what it is, but I find if I refresh, that helps, so. If I'm not responding on chat, you guys, you know why. My cursor goes in there, but it doesn't give me the option of typing in there. So, and then I have to refresh.
Yeah, I've been having to do that as well, and it could be that we are in conflict somehow, and I don't know what that it reassigns both of us as cosmic citizen.
Right.
I haven't figured out how to deal with that yet, but
it's never been a problem.
But I'm
before,
not able
but,
to chat
know.
Either.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Andre, just a quick question. Have you considered just asking them to replace your phone, since that's a pretty substantial problem?
Well, it's not under warranty anymore. So I will have to place it myself. I do have another phone. I can call in from another number, but this one is the one that I called in to start the show. So I've got to keep calling in on this one.
Well, hopefully these technical issues.
By the way, have we reminded?
Out. Yeah, Andre.
Have we reminded our listeners that we're off the air next week? We should do that now.
No, go ahead.
In the middle of the show.
Okay. We're off next week because there's a great Chicago Society is putting on an event on February 11th about the birth of the forum, and anybody interested in the Arrancher book would like to know about that, I think, and how it was created and why. And they have some of the great Chicago old guard on there talking about it, people like Marilyn Kulicki and Barbara Newsom, and they were young when it all happened, you know, like young teenagers, but they've been around this phenomenon for so long. So it'll be an excellent conference, I think. And that's on
Zoom.
It actually
starts Friday night and runs through Sunday morning, but there's a lot going on Saturday. And so we will defer we will not webcast in order to allow for people to attend that. And I'll try to find some information and see if I can put it up in the chat, but or at least announce it on air as to what it is.
Okay, great.
By the way,
thank
are we
you,
ready
Andre.
To read?
Yes. We are on section 3, God is a Universal Spirit. And who would like to read that? This is paper 1, by the way.
Well, I could read it. I haven't read it before.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. This is taking me back in time, remembering when I first read these words. I was just thinking about the authors of these papers, knowing they're going to be delivering this into the minds of mortals. They're going to go, whoa. Anyway, I'll just read. So God is a universal spirit. God is spirit. He is a universal spiritual presence. The Universal Father is an infinite spiritual reality. He is, quote, the sovereign, eternal, immortal, invisible, and only true God, end quote. Even though you are, quote, the offspring of God, you ought not to think that the Fathers like yourselves in form and physique, because you are said to be created, quote, in his image. Indwelt by mystery monitors, dispatched from the central abode of his eternal presence. Spirit beings are real, notwithstanding they are invisible to human eyes, even though they have not flesh and blood. So they're real, even though they don't have flesh and blood. Said the seer of old, quote, lo, he goes by me, and I see him not. He passes on also, but I perceive him not, end quote. We may constantly observe the works of God. We may be highly conscious of the material evidences of his majestic conduct, but rarely may we gaze upon the visible manifestation of his divinity, not even to behold the presence of his delegated spirit of human indwelling. The Universal Father is not invisible because he is hiding himself away from the lowly creatures of materialistic handicaps and limited spiritual endowments. The situation rather is, quote, you cannot see my face, for no mortal can see me and live, unquote. We'll have to come back and talk about this. No material man or woman, of course, could behold the Spirit of God and preserve his mortal existence. The glory and the spiritual brilliance of the divine personality presence is impossible of approach by the lower groups of spirit beings or by any order of material personalities. The spiritual luminosity of the Father's personal presence is a, quote, light which no mortal man can approach, which no material creature has seen or can see. I wonder where these quotes must be biblical, but anyway. And they say, but it is not necessary to see God with the eyes of the flesh in order to discern him by faith vision of the spiritualized mind. That's where it gets interesting. The spirit nature of the Universal Father is shared fully with his coexistent self, the Eternal Son of Paradise. Both the Father and the Son, in like manner, share the universal and eternal spirit fully and unreservedly with their conjoint personality coordinate, the Infinite Spirit. God's spirit is in and of himself absolute. In the Son, it is unqualified. In the Spirit, universal. And in and by all of them, infinite. Interesting threefold nature of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Come back to that too. God is the universal Spirit. God is the universal person. The supreme personal reality of the infinite creation is Spirit.
The finite reality creation.
Yeah, let me read that again. The supreme personal reality of the finite creation is Spirit. The ultimate reality of the personal cosmos is absonite Spirit. Only the levels of infinity are absolute, and only on such levels is there finality of oneness between matter, mind, and Spirit. Interesting. In the universes, God the Father is, in potential, the over-controller of matter, mind, and spirit. Only by means of his far-flung personality circuit does God deal directly with the personalities of his vast creation of will creatures. But he is contactable outside of paradise only in the presences of his fragmented entities, the will of God abroad in the universes. The paradise spirit that indwells the minds of the mortals of time and there fosters the evolution of the immortal soul of the surviving creatures is of the nature and divinity of the Universal Father. But the minds of such evolutionary creatures originate in the local universes and must gain divine perfection by achieving those experiential transformations of spiritual attainment, which are the inevitable result of a creature's choosing to do the will of the Father in heaven. In the inner experiences of man, mind is joined to matter. Such material-linked minds cannot survive mortal death. The technique of survival is embraced in those adjustments of the human will and those transformations in the mortal mind whereby such a God-conscious intellect gradually becomes spirit-taught and eventually spirit-led. The evolution of the human mind from matter association to spirit union results in the transmutation of the potentially spirit phases of the mortal mind into the Mirantia realities of the immortal soul. Mortal mind subservient to matter is destined to become increasingly material and consequently to suffer eventual personality extinction. Mind yielded to spirit is destined to become increasingly spiritual and ultimately to achieve oneness with the surviving and guiding divine spirit, and in this way to attain survival and eternity of personality existence. Simple enough, right? I come forth from the Eternal, who's the author of the paper, is what, a divine counselor, I think?
Mm-hmm.
I read about that. Okay. Paradise, origin being, I believe. I come forth from the Eternal, and I've repeatedly returned to the presence of the Universal Father. I know of the actuality and personality of the first source and center, the Eternal and Universal Father. I know that while the great God is absolute, eternal, and infinite, he is also good, divine, and great and gracious. I know the truth of the great declarations, quote, God is spirit and God is love. And these two attributes are most completely revealed to the universe in the Eternal Son.
Mm-hmm. What an amazing section.
Boy, there's a lot in there. What's that?
Yeah.
Astounding. And, you know, I go back to what you were saying earlier, Paul. I mean, there are parts of it that lodge with me and parts of it that just, large parts that just kind of, whoa, feel like they go way over my head as we read this.
Well, you know, I notice there's so many things that jump out. That's the hard part about discussing any section in UH's book. Just pick mm-hmm. one, you know. But I love, first off, that they give us a definition of what was meant by we are created in God's image.
Yeah.
And in the very first paragraph, they tell us, you know, we're said to be created in his image, and then they do that dash, or what is that called, that long hyphen?
M dash,
okay. Indwelt by mystery monitors, dispatched from the central abode of his eternal presence. That's what they mean by in his image. We're indwelt by him.
By his spirit,
essentially.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, by his spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I love, I mean, you can just see how they're struggling to clarify so many misconceptions in the human mind. And this whole idea of spirit, I think, is a big one. Mm. You know, it's so hard to define. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that, you know, it's so real and yet so hard to define. And so here they are, you know, trying to define it for us. Lo, he goes by me and I see him not. He passes on also, but I perceive him not. And so often we humans, you know, then they touch on it in that second to the last paragraph, minds that are linked to matter. You know, that's a problem if we see everything in a material way. If it's all material and relevant only because we can see it, feel it, touch it, taste it, smell it, you know, they're trying to tell us that there's greater realities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they tell us that, you know, we have to experience it, then that makes perfect sense. But how do you do that? Well, you start to contemplate it, I think. And or, you know, reach out with your faith in sincere contemplation of spiritual realities. And then you begin to feel, you know, which is what validates it. That's how you experience it, right?
Well, the concept of presence enters into it right away. Because that's what we feel. That's what we can feel. We can feel that presence within us, even though, as they say, we cannot see it. You know, not even to behold the presence of his delegated spirit of human indwelling. So we can't expect to see that with our eyes, but we can feel it.
Yeah. Oftentimes when I've,
like you're saying,
when I've been praying, you know,
Yeah, be focused on that possibility. Then it becomes,
Then you experience it. Now, I was just going to say, what I experience when I'm praying is, especially if I have an issue, the feeling is peace. A calmness just comes over me. and a comforting sense of it's going to be okay. You know, it's all going to be okay. And that's been a very common experience for me, and a feeling of peace when I reach out to the spirit.
Yeah, well, like in that last line of the fifth paragraph, they say, it's not necessary to see God with the eyes of the flesh in order to discern him by the faith vision of the spiritualized mind. I mean, that's language that when you first come across it, it's in my case, you go, to think
faith
about that.
Vision.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Marvin, you were going to say something. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
No, it just, yeah, it's just something small. Just it goes back to this, there's a realm of experiencing, and I think they use the word feelings for it, that is the soul experience, you know. We begin slowly but surely to feel and to experience something that is not material at all, and it's the realm of values. It's the realm of, you know, love and truth and beauty and goodness that begins to guide us that are beyond material realities, and they become increasingly real in our lives as we work with them and we open to the influence and the inspiration of the spirit. And it's an emerging sort of realm of sensing things. And they use the word feelings. They say that which feels spiritual values is the soul. You know, which combines the sense of intellectual knowledge and material reality and begins to work directly with values, the values that the Father is trying to show us.
And values are felt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, love is one of the greatest examples of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly one of the main, if not the main, spiritual value. The greatest of all motivations, right? That just it's primary, let's say. And if you've never felt it, you wouldn't know it. And you feel it because somebody loved you. You know how it feels. And I think we all experience loving somebody too, you know, so we know it from both aspects, outgoing and incoming. Right? But if it's only outgoing and never incoming, it's never reciprocated, I think that's really detrimental. That's why it's so
probably
important.
Probably hard to even make that happen.
I wonder if even could.
Yeah. It would be a lot harder anyway. If you haven't experienced love, especially, you know, when you're from the infant stage on forward, particularly from your parents, you know, a small child that is just loved and loved and loved by their parents. Is going to have just be bathing in that incoming that you're talking about. And then it's only natural to want to be that way too. You know, it's like they always talk about becoming more godlike. That's kind of what that is in a way, like you're saying, to have that loving nature that we discover with God.
Yeah.
It's probably harder to find that if you haven't experienced it humanly. Just speculating.
Yeah, I just wonder. And I think those concepts around love get skewed oftentimes, you know, by our own humanness and our own lack of understanding of what love really is. And the Urantia book defines it so well, right? It tells us that it differentiates between divine love, being outgoing in all of its satisfaction seeking. And I have always thought of love as being like a reservoir. When people love you, they fill you back up. And you have all that much more to give then. You know?
Well, that's the thing. You can give love without ever exhausting the supply.
Especially if you're letting the divine love just replenish.
Right. That's what I mean.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's,
well within. Yeah.
Pam on the board said we need, or she said Desjardins describes love as the energy of the universe. I like to think of it as God's currency. So that's interesting, Pam, because current, the word current is in currency. And it is. It's the divine energy. It's what he pours out on all of us. And
I think that's what feeling is
what we're talking about in a way, feeling that love.
His love.
You know?
Well, so the expression then divides into the qualities of divinity. It's, you know, truth, beauty, and goodness.
Right.
So when we feel truth, we feel beauty, we feel goodness, we're feeling love. Those are, in a sense, like qualities of love.
Or values, as Marvin said.
Well, yeah, values for sure. Yeah. But it's also, they're qualities that we try to achieve. We want to have true understanding. We want to make beautiful things. And we want to, you know, have the spirit of goodness within us. It really inspires the highest kinds of love, I think.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Anyway,
so, yeah,
conceptually at least, it's interesting how they map that out. It's one thing to say, okay, well, let's try to be more loving, but then they make it clear that the primary values associated with love are truth, beauty, and goodness. So that gives us kind of a roadmap. It gives us something that we can hold on to as we try to live that love that exists within us.
It's interesting, too. There's no human that doesn't value those things.
Pretty much, yeah. Right.
Value
truth, really on the wrong
value
track.
Beauty, and value goodness, right? And goodness,
yeah.
Especially.
It's the spiritual
goodness
life
is,
within them, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that you can't see God, I wanted to ask you guys, and that's in paragraph 3, he's not invisible because he's hiding. You cannot see my face, for no mortal can see me and live. No material man could behold the spirit God and preserve his mortal existence.
Well,
you know, I was just thinking the other day, if Jesus showed up in his person, and this is something I was going to ask you guys, you know, being now a master son, complete, although he was one of us, so he's always connected to us, I wonder if the same is not true for him in his personal presence even now, if you were to be transported. And what I was thinking was, if I was to be transported to his personal presence, or if he were to show up in his personal presence right now, my heart would probably explode.
Are you talking about in physical form?
If the reality of the being, Christ Michael of Nebadon, in his full personal self was to show up in front of me, my heart would probably explode. I don't know if I could maintain.
Well, we'll be meeting him on the imagined world. I mean, I think there's some point fairly early on. So,
I don't think my heart will explode at that
literally.
Point.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, the paradise presence, I think, is a little anyway. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, that's pretty far removed from us.
But I mean
the miracle, the miracle of his incarnation was that they did the reverse. They brought him down to us. They brought the person of God down to us in a form that we could encounter the divine. And still survive and still be impacted and see it and have it affect us, which is why I think Jesus' life and teachings are so powerful. is because we see the spirit values so fully embodied, and what it must have been like to be in the Master's presence. And we've talked about this before. I do think mm-hmm. that early in our Marantia experience, we will experience his life much more directly, not just on words on a page, but we'll see the events as if we were there, you know, I think early in the Marantia life, because I think it's that important for our early spiritual development in those early mansion worlds. So, I mean, that's some kind of response to your question, Paula. It's like, you know, we can't be brought up to that level, but that level came down to our level
mm-hmm.
and manifested
yeah,
as a person, and lives those values in a way that really touched us. And that's part
and
of
also,
why this part
yeah.
part four is so powerful.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it really speaks to the whole universe's paradigm of, you know, what they were just saying, what we just read in this section. You cannot see my face, for no mortal can see me and live. It's like a reality, and they accept it, but they have to attenuate it down to this
mm-hmm.
level, and that's exactly what they do with the Creator Son. And
yeah.
why his life is so precious to us. Oh, my gosh. It means so much to us to have that. That, you know, he made, it's like he said, I'm the lens in human likeness that makes visible to your creature eyes him who is invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, that's pretty amazing.
That last sentence in paragraph three, the third one, but it is not necessary to see God with the eyes of the flesh in order to discern him
mm-hmm.
by the faith vision of the spiritualized mind. I think that's what was happening with Jesus when he was here. He began to so spiritualize and sensitize the minds of those around him that they began increasingly to see who he was and
mm-hmm.
see God by faith vision, by insight, not by material
mm-hmm.
vision.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I was
just going to
comment.
Process
of transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say this paragraph, the earlier part of this paragraph, almost reminds me of adjuster fusion. You know, if you fuse with your adjuster during your material lifetime, it would take you up in the atmosphere where your body is blasted away or something. You know, it's quite a phenomenon. You know, chariots of fire. And that, it's almost like if you were to be in the presence of God on paradise, it would sort of be the same thing. You couldn't stand there as a material being and expect to maintain your material existence. It would be sort of like a just refusal. You just get, I don't know, something similar. It must be going on in a sense. I don't know if that makes sense, but...
Well, that's really interesting. If you take a look at that sentence, say, no material man... That's interesting. No material man could behold the
right.
Spirit of God and preserve his mortal, yeah, and preserve his mortal existence. That doesn't mean
exactly.
that
yeah.
that his Marantia existence wouldn't be preserved. You know, so you're
yeah.
right. I mean, that could have something to do with why that fusion occur. You know, results in the immediate dissolution of the mortal vehicle, mortal existence, and translation to a higher realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, and Pam on the board asked me if I'm wondering if the Marantia Jesus is different from the Master Son Michael, and you know, I actually think, you know, like us, all of those incarnations, all of those bestowals are in him all at once, just like us. Every year we've ever lived is still in us. That's my theory. I have this theory that people are like trees. If you cut a tree down, you see all of those rings, right? That represents every little year of existence or whatever in that, like in the life of that tree. I think people are like
mm-hmm.
that. You know, we have those rings that are all there simultaneously with us, and at the center is always the tender sapling the tender, you know, New Agers like to call it, the inner child. And so Jesus has Michael, but he has even Todd, and he has Jesus. And
all of his,
you know,
souls.
All of them, yeah, they're
yeah.
all there.
Yeah.
And so it's twofold in a way. Just this conversation makes me realize that we ascend to him, but he descends to us, and in so doing makes himself available to all, more readily available to all of his creatures in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
More
yeah.
readily approachable, you know, or even fully approachable.
And whether it be Michael or Jesus or one of his souls or Ms. Maranshan, I mean, it's the same personality. That's the thing. It's the same personality
right.
in
yeah.
all those incarnations and manifestations, however you want to describe them. It's still the same person. That's what's so crazy about it.
It's amazing to think he brought God to all of us, not just us humans,
yeah.
to every
yeah.
creature in his domain.
Mm-hmm.
He made
right.
God
can see
accessible.
What God looks like in, yeah,
right.
as themselves.
This is, I think, probably one of the great problems that, you know, especially for material beings, that we can't see, and that so we have little. If we want to access God, we have to spiritualize our mind.
Mm-hmm.
We have to gain faith, vision, or insight. Marvin, you called it insight, which I think is accurate. You know, faith, vision is insight, probably.
Faith, insight.
It's another definition.
Certainly,
yeah.
certainly a thing. Yeah.
Faith, vision.
Faith,
what we see with our faith. What we see with our
yeah.
faith. You know, what a great mm-hmm. question that is to ask yourself, probably. What do I see with my faith? What do I see by faith?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I went did a search in the book to find all the hyphenated uses of faith, you know, faith
mm.
something, faith hyphen,
right.
hyphen something. There's like a ton of them. And it's so enlightening to go through them all and look at them. It's like, oh, okay. Anyway, but yeah, faith vision is one of them. It's a quality of vision that's associated with faith. So there's like faith discovery, faith insight, faith realization, faith, all kinds of
yeah,
capacities
it's a
that
whole,
open up with faith, in other words. Yeah.
It's a whole other realm of being.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Your
well, it says how important
with
faith is. Faith
yeah.
is when properly understood.
Yeah.
Faith is another one of those
exactly.
tricky words. Kind of like spirit or personality.
And it's one that they so love because they spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah. Well, they're challenging us to grasp a higher understanding of what faith actually is, I think.
Yeah, just the word faith occurs 531 times in the book.
Really?
And,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right, you know, if you just type in faith, all the hyphenated faith comes up too. So like faith grasp and faith vision and et cetera. Those
yeah,
all come
yeah.
up as 30, well,
34 occurrences of faith hyphen. Faith hyphen. So like faith trust, faith grasped, faith tested, faith fact. That's a good one.
Mm.
Faith
mm.
child, faith insight, faith liberated, faith born,
mm.
Faith glimpse, faith insight, faith trust, faith submission to the will of the Father. Wow. Faith activated, just faith activated soul. Faith son is the same God. So faith discover. You faith discover yourselves as sons. Faith dominated persons. Faith adventure. Faith accepted. Faith entrance into the kingdom. Faith
wow.
realization that you are a son of God. Faith enlightened. and spirit liberated. Faith quickened mortals are the sons of God. The firmer faith holds is Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Every time he prayed in the garden, humanity laid a firmer faith hold upon his divinity. Faith growing mortals, faith fellows, faith grasp, faith comrades. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you,
Chuck. Yeah.
That's really intriguing. How much faith has to do with all of this.
Yeah.
The very fact that we can read this and say, okay, I have faith that this great spirit at the center of all things exists. I have faith that this great spirit exists in me.
Yeah.
I have faith that I am his child. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have faith in my friends. You know, of faith. You know, it's really interesting how much it plays a part in everything in terms of these spiritual conceptions that we're looking at here.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to just reach out and say, I have faith. And what that means. To each person in their own way, you know. And boy, my prayer is always that people will have it, because I don't know how they get through this life without it. Actually, you know, intact. And,
yeah, we're trying to
hide
faith into our lives. We want to have faith lives.
Yes, we're grafting. It's so much
that
part of
in
who
there.
We are. Yeah, get that in there. Well, so here's another statement that, you know, Marvin, you said some things, we were talking about the things that go in your heart and the things that go flying over your head.
Mm-hmm.
Paragraph 5 is kind of like that for me. God is a universal spirit. God is the universal person, the supreme personal reality of the finite creation is spirit. The ultimate reality of the personal cosmos is absolute spirit. Only the levels of infinity are absolute. And only on such levels is there finality of oneness between matter, mind, and spirit. Anyone want to take a crack at that, Andre? Marvin,
yeah.
Doug?
I mean, I'll defer to anybody if they want to crack at it first, but in the first place, they make it clear to us that the supreme personal reality, that in the realms of the finite, the approach to God is entirely through spirit, that there's no approach through material reality, and they just made that, I mean, they make that point in the subsequent paragraphs. You know, especially paragraph 7. But they try to give us a little bit of insight into the nature of our progression beyond the finite. You know, once we've found God, we have in essence embarked upon maybe even before that. But once we have found God in finality on the third circuit of Avona and become perfect, we really have reached, in a certain sense, the finite pinnacle of who we are destined to be. And by the time we're mustered into the core of the finality as sixth-stage spirits, we are already enjoying some experience, before that, but definitely then, we're exploring some of the absolute and ultimate reality of who we are. And they're trying to make that point, and they do it in such an odd way, in a certain sense, by virtue of how they turn around some of the adjectives to get us to think about this differently. The ultimate reality of the personal cosmos is absolute spirit. Now, think about how that's different from supreme personal reality of finite creation versus now taking that creation, calling it a cosmos, and describing the personal cosmos. That's a very interesting thing to do. It's indicating in a certain sense how much more at that level personality realities and non-personality realities are not conflated but are intermingled. You know, there is a beginning of not blurring, although there may be some of that, but there's some indication that on that level, the unity that we see on the absolute level, only the levels of infinity are absolute, and only on such levels is there finality of oneness between matter and mind and spirit. Mm. Well, just like they say on Paradise, we couldn't tell you much about Manota, something that is differentiated from Paradise Spirit only in name. That's on the absolute level. In the same way, they're saying, as we explore it experientially, on the absolute level, if we ever get to exploring the cosmos infinite, once the master universe is settled in completion of its ultimate status, in, you know, finality of absonity and ultimacy, when God the ultimate emerges, we will be exploring that unity of oneness between matter, mind, and spirit. But on the way to that, on four levels, through the first outer space level, second outer space level, third and fourth, something that's going to take an immeasurable amount of time as far as we're concerned, we will be exploring this increasing unity and this increasing relatedness among spirit, mind, and matter in that way. That's the closest I come to understanding something there. But they're still indicating that the approach through ultimate reality is through absonite spirit. But it's going to be a spirit that begins to take on some of these other mindful and material qualities. It's going to be something transcendent to what we understand as spirit now. But all they can do is be descriptive and call it something. So they call it something that they've defined for us, absonity, that is that intermediate reality between the finite and the absolute. Something that they then, in other parts, indicate has this this intermingled reality.
Mm.
How's that?
Pam, I loved it. Thank you. Pam on the board said, absonite, transitional combo of absolute and finite. You know, but it's, so if I understand you correctly, they're talking about the phase in between where, and it's Jesus saying, you know, forewarn all believers of the fringe of conflicts that must be traversed as they go from life as it is lived in the material to life as it is lived in the spiritual. And either, you know, conflict isn't as intense in the material or the spiritual, but everyone is destined to experience conflict in the interim. And that's just another way of describing that intervening phase. Which is, if I understand you correctly, that's what they mean by absonite, where things are commingled.
What you were indicating was really clearly still part of finite reality, that we have it more clear cut. We are not looking so much to be in denial of material reality, but to put it in its proper place as subservient to mind, as mind is directed by spirit. That's definitely where matter should be going in finite reality, as far as our personal progression goes. And yet, and maybe this is why we're qualified to pursue absinthe reality in some way, we are living out reality in the material realm. We're learning how to weave spiritual realities, or at least spiritual realities as contained in the Marantia, out of a material existence, out of material evolutionary life that we're experiencing here. Now, that's a pretty remarkable kind of a, you know, and it hasn't, I mean, it's being done trillions upon trillions of times in each mortal life that chooses to do it. And yet, it's completely unusual. It's the mystery, it contains the mystery of mysteries, because in order to affect that, it requires a thought adjuster. It requires a thought adjuster to incept a soul in a material being living a life, and it requires a minded material being who is just capable beginning to suppose that there is something greater than themselves that is responsible for their existence and that loves them. And as you begin to get that idea, there are character values that come into being. And those character values are those skyhooks on which we can climb out of material reality.
That is good. Thank you. It really helps with that paragraph 7 too, that description. That, and I find this paragraph to be, to me, one of the most intriguing in the book, is paragraph 7 on this section. In the inner experience of man, mind is joined to matter. Such material-linked minds cannot survive mortal death. The technique of survival is embraced in those adjustments of the human will and those transformations in the mortal mind whereby such a God-conscious intellect gradually becomes spirit-taught and eventually spirit-led. This evolution of the human mind from matter association to spirit union results in the transmutation of the potentially spirit phases of the mortal mind into the Marantia realities of the immortal soul. Mortal mind subservient to matter is destined to become increasingly material and consequently to suffer eventual personality extinction. Mind yields to spirit is destined to become increasingly spiritual and ultimately to achieve oneness with the surviving and guiding divine spirit, and in this way to attain survival and eternity of personality existence. Now, in shorthand, for me, what that's saying is we become what we identify with. We increasingly become more spiritual when we contemplate spirit realities, link our minds to spirit, and eventually become, go from being spirit taught to spirit led. And that's an evolution, a transmutation. That's the the remarkable birth of the soul that has the potential to survive death and become eternal. That's the potentially immortal part of each of us. And so what I get is, if you link your mind to material things and you become holy, you become like those things. That's in the simplest terms for me. You become like those things. And as we know, all material things have an expiration date.
Yeah.
their days
Dang
are
it.
Numbered. I know.
Can't take it with you.
Yeah.
Can't take it with you.
Yeah.
Well, and so to me,
well, in here, though. Yeah. Go ahead.
Just connected with that is the paragraph up above, where they say only by means above the one you read, which is paragraph 6, only by means of his far-flung personality circuit does God deal directly with the personalities of his vast creation of will creatures. But he is contactable only in the presences of his fragmented entities, the will of God abroad in the universe. This paradise spirit, the thought adjusters, that indwells the minds of the mortals of time and there fosters the evolution of the immortal soul of the surviving creature, is of the nature and divinity of the Universal Father. Those are very directly linked statements, I think, to the paragraph
mm-hmm.
you read as well, Paula.
I'm glad you brought that up, Martin. I wonder if I could get some clarification here about one thing. In what you just read, they say that the Father is contactable outside of paradise only in the presences of his fragmented entities. Okay, so holding that in mind, and then reading what they say, actually say about the personality circuit, let's see, this is in paper 5, section 6, paradise, paragraph 10, they say, the personality circuit of the universe of universes is centered in the person of the Universal Father, and the Paradise Father is personally conscious of and in personal touch with all personalities of all levels of self-conscious existence. And this personality consciousness of all creation exists independently of the mission of the thought adjusters. So there they're saying that the Father is personally conscious and in touch, personal touch with each of us. I mean, couldn't be more clear. So if he's aware, the Father is aware of me, what a thought, then it seems like he would be contactable via the personality circuit. You know,
yeah.
Aware of what's in my mind, all I got to do is say, hey, hi, hello, and he'll hear that, right? How could it be any other way? So when they say that he's not contactable, they must be meaning that in some kind of a technical sense, like that the kind of contact you'd actually have by being in someone's presence. Literal presence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm trying to resolve those.
Personally, the contact to the circuit is very different than we will someday enjoy. I mean, if it wasn't important to progress to the end of the third circuit of Avona and see the Father, then
find the Father. Yeah.
To find the Father, there would be no difference between being in touch with the thought adjuster and being in the personality circuit. The fact is that we only know the tiniest, tiniest aspect of who the Father is as a person. And we can be grateful for the fact that we've had the life and teachings of Jesus to be able to reflect upon to get us that much further. But it's just the beginning. And being in touch with a thought adjuster who carries the will of God for us, for each one of us, in the universe somehow is giving us that greater contact, even if it's not personal contact. It's contact with God.
It's
as close as we can get. Yeah.
But I think that the personality circuit also gives us access,
God,
let's say.
It would have to. I would think it would have to because prior to the universal outpouring of thought adjusters, made possible by the Spirit of Truth, by Jesus' Spirit of Truth and his bestowal, people were able to make contact and then subsequently get a thought adjuster, right? There was a way. I mean, they even tell us that Cain did exactly that. He started, his mother was able to, teach him enough about God that he started to contemplate God, and he was given a thought adjuster, and then he became among the feared tribe of Adam, right? So that's intriguing to me, because the primitives could actually see it in him. They actually perceived it. You know, so it was...
It asked for help. Mm-hmm. That was the main thing, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But just to underscore one point in that paragraph, remember that is the Father being in contact with us. And it's his perfect consciousness, independent of the mission of the thought adjusters. We are in contact with him and in the circuit of love of the Father as a result of the personality circuit. But our consciousness of that is quite variable and quite low in comparison.
Mm.
We are much more capable of being conscious of God within us than of God on paradise.
That's a good point.
Well, they discuss that in the section about prayer and the alter ego.
Mm.
That very issue is discussed in some detail. You know, that we have right with us, near us, you know, this divine alter
ego. By the way, that reference was 5:6:10 that you referred to, just for our listeners. I know there are people out there that like to have them, and I'm not able to post in the chat the way I typically have, but it's you usually cite that, and I'll just cite it for you, 5:6:10.
Okay, thank you. Well, there's one more, which is 32:4:8, where they say that personality circuit, the Father is cognizant, has personal knowledge of all the thoughts and acts of all the beings and all the systems of all the universes of all creation. So, knowing that the Father has cognizance of my thoughts, if I direct my thoughts toward the Father, he'd be aware of that. I guess is all I'm trying to say. But that's another way of reaching for God. You know, that, like in the prayer and the alter ego, they say we can do it either way. But for practical purposes, it might work better remembering that we have this onboard alter ego that we can access immediately all the time, but not to discount reaching for the Father himself directly over the personality circuit. I think we have both that we can develop, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And it really highlights why it would be important to know that he is a person, you know?
Right, right.
Not an it. Although he is the first source and center of all things and beings, so he is an it too, but primarily a person who can know and be known, you know, who can love and be loved. So important.
Speaking of that, here's one more. This is 5:6:11. This may be the most important aspect of this. 5:6:11, they say, so is all personality circuited in the personal presence of the Universal Father. And this circuit unerringly transmits the worship of all personalities to the original and eternal personality.
Mm-hmm.
So our worship of God goes directly over the personality circuit to the Father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just woven throughout all of this conversation, I think there's a distinction that keeps reoccurring to me, and that is, what is God aware of through the personality circuit, and what are we aware of through the personality circuit? And I think what they're saying is God is aware of everything related to us as persons from God's awareness, but what we're aware of is only discernible through our contact with the prepersonal fragments. And yet everything that we direct toward God as a person is discerned by God and appreciated. So I think there's recognition, but I think it goes back to what Andre was saying, is that we're at the barest beginning of our sense of our personal relationship with God. It's there, but it's very, very embryonic. And to the extent our souls emerge, we begin to have more of a sense of God's personal presence. I think intellectually it's very limited, but soul perception-wise, soul feeling-wise, it begins to grow and grows further and further.
Yeah.
And that's what's survivable out of this life into the next life is that soul perception and that soul existence, which is, you know, they tell us over and over that that's the case.
Yeah.
Probably of all the revelations of the Urantia book, that particular one, which I know it's been said before in the still small voice and the Ka and the Ba and all of those things, but not like this. And for me, that was... It's a feeling without a word. It for me, because I always felt that presence, I couldn't define it, and I didn't necessarily know what it was. But when I learned about the presence of God in me, then it all made sense. Everything came together around that. It's like, oh, now I get it. It's so close. It's so personal. It's so made for you and for me and for each of us and the uniqueness of each of us to be given this fragment that will take us home. And that we don't have to look outside ourselves way off far in the skies, you know.
But we can do that.
But we can do that, sure.
Yeah, we can do
and
both.
Yeah, we can do both. But we don't have to go to middlemen. You know, I mean, the ramifications
for sure.
of that one teaching, which is, of course, Jesus reiterated many times in many ways. But even the way Jesus said it, you know, it was like, well, what? You know, the kingdom of heaven is in the hearts of men. Okay, well, what's he getting at there? You know? But when you read these concepts of the thought adjuster, the mystery monitor, the divine indweller, all of a sudden, all of that makes more sense. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
Every religious longing, every human ideal, every relationship, all of it makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
So that's
well, like the three evidences that, you know, reading from the earlier section, you know, at the beginning, those urges.
Can you reiterate those?
God. Yeah. These are what they list as evidences. Well, the presence of the adjuster is disclosed by these three experiential phenomena. The intellectual capacity for knowing God, which would be God consciousness. The spiritual urge to find God, which would be God seeking. And the personality craving to be like God, the wholehearted desire to do the Father's will. So the adjuster sponsors all three of those urges in a pre-personal sort of way. But it's still all about having communion with the Father, I think, ultimately. And the adjuster coaches us and teaches us how to do that. Because it is the presence of the Father within us. But there's kind of almost like a handshake that evolves over time.
Yeah.
as we respond to these urges and grow, you know, as our God-seeking efforts begin to bear fruit, as we become more conscious, you know, knowing God through God consciousness, and then striving to be like God, that's where the transformation really takes place. And that desire to do the Father's will, then we become more like God. Our personality is, our expression of personality is transformed by that.
Where is that citation, Chuck?
That's the intro paragraph and then the little list begins in 1, 2, 3.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Number one, section two.
That's the 1, 2, 3. Yep, got it.
1, 2, 3, then 4, 5, 6.
Know God, seek God, and desire to do his will.
Right.
Okay.
Well, the craving, to the craving crazy deal I got. I mean, I remember first being, you know, hitting upon this language. And I think, wow, it's crazy to be like God, huh? There must be something about God that's like really appealing. If I'm going to crave to be like him, where the whole urge to worship comes in too.
Just
a quick connection where the phrasing they use when they say that the soul craves and initiates worship.
Mm-hmm.
So the craving to be like God and the craving to worship are just that's a common thread there. That's all. Go ahead, Paula.
Oh, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just think it's inherent in us to want to be better. But what, based on what you were just saying too, I think we want to worship based on our own limitations, you know, based on our own humanness. And I'm thinking about, you know, the epiphanies people have around addiction and when they go into the 12-step program. And one of the steps is, you know, to admit your own limitations. And then another one is to admit that there's something better, God, whatever you conceive God to be, and that you can surrender some of your human concerns to that greater reality. And what a comfort that is. And that would be why we crave that. We crave to know that we're not alone in all of this struggle. You know, that there's something that has our back. Something that will see us through and hold us no matter what happens. Why wouldn't we crave that, especially on this planet? Man, oh man. You know, sometimes I like to think about what these things feel like to someone who's living on a world of light and life. You know, if they were given these teachings, you know, I like to think about how would that feel to them? You know, of course they know it. Everything for thousands of years has pointed to it. Every teaching they've ever been given, every reinforcement from the universe and the universe of universes has indicated that this is true. Of course it is. Yes, of course. But we have to take it on faith, which I guess is what makes us Agon daughters, right?
Mm. Yeah, what this would be to a light and lifer would be a revelation of how different human evolution could be for some worlds, because of what it would indicate about what is not there that they already know.
Mm.
That would be part of what this revelation would do, were they ever to be exposed to it. And who knows? Who knows what we all get to study on our way up, and what we appreciate about each other world. I think we're going to be blown away when we just come to our first normal world that is our age, you know? And we see, oh.
What could have been?
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you know, I think they could probably, on the other hand, they could come down here and say, oh, okay. So they still string their power across in lines through the sky, you know. I mean, there would be certain things that would be so obvious about us and where we are in our evolution with technology and with other things. We would be really transparent to them. But what would be such a delight would be to be there and see how they've solved some of these problems that are so, you know, pernicious to us. Where we can say, oh, God, it's so simple. Oh, my God, look at how they did that. Isn't that remarkable?
Well, and looking at things like,
look at all we learned.
Look what you can do when you just have masses of humanity cooperating with one another. Because
oh, yeah.
they see it, they see the value in it right away, versus those that say, what's in for me, or, you know, why should I do that?
They have to be coerced or cajoled.
My situation.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Mm. Well, you can actually trust your overseers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
What a concept that is.
We've learned a lot of caution on this world.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're jaded, skeptical. You know, I was going to say
that too.
Well, yeah, especially if you have to live here, right? The art of Marvin has brought up a last couple of episodes, I think, the art of temporal human compromise, which is so essential, you know, that we can focus on God as a reality in the spirit and want to be loyal to spiritual realities. But on some level, we have to live on this planet. So we need to deal with the practical realities that are here.
And that includes being aware of the character of rebellion, being able to tell when there's rebellion influence.
Yeah. And even in America, where we value independence, you know, we are fiercely independent, and we value self-reliance, you know, than to surrender to the will of God.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of faith.
Yeah. I wonder if we could take another look at paragraph 4. We've got a few minutes.
Sure.
In this section, there's some interesting language here that I think maybe gives us some hints about the nature of the Trinity. Like, they say that this spirit nature of the universal Father is fully shared with his coexistent self, the eternal Son of Paradise. And then they say both the Father and the Son, and I stumbled over this when I read it before because I was like, what? Both the Father and the Son in like manner share the universal and eternal Spirit fully and unreservedly with their conjoint personality coordinate, the infinite spirit. And then they say God's spirit is in and of himself absolute, and the Son it is unqualified, and the spirit universal, and in and by all of them infinite. But I guess what I'm trying to get at it here is it sounds like you're talking about one spirit. The Father and the Son, in like manner, share the universal and eternal spirit fully and unreservedly with the conjoint actor. It's like there's one spirit that they all share. But that spirit in the Father is absolute, in the Son it's unqualified, and in the Spirit it's universal, and all of them it's infinite. But it seems like they're talking about one spirit that has these variations in expression through these three coordinate personalities. I wonder if that's...
Well, I mean, that's the paradox.
Making sense. I don't know.
The paradox is that they're one being. God really is one being in spirit and manifesting in three different ways.
Uh-huh.
And that's inherently, for us material beings, that's inherently paradoxical and mysterious. And there's no way to penetrate it. We simply have to accept it. That it's the reality. I keep coming back to the title of the next section, which we'll get into, which is the mystery of God. I mean, it's just inherently mysterious, you know, that somehow he's one being and somehow that spirit is manifesting as three and in relationship with each other, which sets the paradigm for all of relationships in all of creation, you know. And we've talked about this lots before, that, you know, if what's paradigmatic in reality is personality and relationships between persons, fundamentally. It's what's threaded throughout everything, and it's the model for everything and every being.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they.
Well, it's clear the Father, Son, and Spirit are three different personalities, but they share the unity, but they're expressing the same Spirit in three different ways.
Something you know, and the that section ends with this statement: I know that while the great God is absolute, eternal, and infinite, He's also good, divine, and gracious. I know the truth of the great declarations: God is Spirit, and God is love. And these two attributes are most completely revealed to the universe in the eternal Son.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, I think that statement relates to, you know, to the paragraph you read, Chuck.
Yeah, yeah.
And Pam on the board, I have to say, she said there's a joke going around now that the Trinity is two guys and a bird. I had to share that.
Two guys and a bird.
That was my problem. I didn't get it. I didn't get it as a Catholic.
Oh, two guys and a goat.
It was like, yeah, right, exactly. It was like, what? You know,
what?
How come we know so much about the first two and so little about the last one? It didn't make sense to me. And lo and behold, here comes the Urantia book and reveals it all.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we finally have the Father, Son, and Spirit on an equal footing that we can understand. It's really quite a remarkable thing to have gotten this. And I think a lot of us take it for granted at this point what our current understanding is compared to the continual mystery. But less mystery and more mystification of who the persons of the Trinity really are. And some of us had that question when we were growing up, and it wasn't satisfying, even as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? What do you mean the bird? What do you mean a dove? You know?
Right.
What's with this ghost? Am I gonna, like,
well, yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Yeah. The Holy Ghost, that's a little off-putting to a child.
That's a little spooky.
Oh, yeah, the Holy Ghost, yeah. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Yeah. They've gotten away from that. You know, I don't know who I hear. Yeah, I don't know who I hear saying Holy Ghost anymore. It's really Holy Spirit, pretty much.
That's better.
Yeah, that was... Yeah. Well, it indicates something about religious evolution.
Mm.
That, you know, from the time that we were kids to sometime after Vatican II, I don't know when, that started to evolve more in talking about the Holy Spirit and getting away from using that term Holy Ghost.
Mm. Must have had an earlier meaning. It was more like spirit.
Well, it did. It was taken as synonymous, but it was very interesting that they chose to use the word ghost, almost as though they were pandering to early beliefs in, you know, ghost
supernatural. Spirit.
Ghost
fear,
I was just going to say. Yeah.
It's sort of a bit of an indication of the poverty of the English language that they would make those two as synonymous.
Yeah.
Like I was just looking at
the
title of the section, God is Universal Spirit. Well, what if they would never say God is Universal Ghost?
it would be such a
distortion of the meaning. So, I mean, part of what they're doing is so profoundly redefining what the word spirit means in sections like this.
Oh, yeah, right.
To the extent
which
that you
no
can't think
thing.
That way anymore. Yeah, you can't think that way anymore after having read the Urantia book. It becomes absurd once your thoughts are reformed in that way.
Right.
And that's why study of the book is really so significant. It really is a paradigmatic change, an expansion of the paradigm that now you look at it, you could not shoehorn, you know, the new concepts into the old, the old concepts the way they were. They just don't fit anymore.
Yep. They don't fit. It's putting the new wine into the old skins.
Especially once you begin to have actual experiential growth and development, to experience using the improved concepts, then it really locks them in because it's how you get traction in reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates a growth environment, you know, within the mind, can reach for spirit more effectively, I think. That's why it's so important.
I think we've all known somebody who kind of imports their biblical prophecies over to the Urantia teachings and tries to make them work, you know, the biblical prophecies about end times and whatever in Revelation and all of that, tries to make that, you know, use the Urantia book to validate those biblical teachings. And some of them are, you know, some of them you can do and some of them you absolutely can't do. But somebody once explained it to me because there's been various people in the movement who have made some pretty amazing prophecies about end times and stuff going strictly from biblical, using the Urantia book, but going mostly from the Bible. And this person said, well, you have to look at the Bible through the large lens of the Urantia book. You can't look at the Urantia book through the small lens of the Bible. And I thought that was really helpful to me, you know, that in understanding what's going on. Yeah. That sometimes people tend to want to view the Urantia book through the lens of the Bible, and it just really doesn't work that way very well. It's much better to do it the other way around, to view the Bible through the lens of the Urantia book. And probably any other great spiritual teachings, the Urantia book could enhance in that way, you know, as a magnifier, an enhancement. Yeah. But Marvin, did you have something you wanted to share about? Okay. All right. Trying to read the cues here.
Let me take, I can do this.
Okay.
Brief promo for the Midwest Conference. Let
me
let people know what they need to do. You've been asked to email in order to get the Zoom link. Email First Society is what this email pertains to. And that email is simply Urantia Chicago, one word, @gmail.com. So URANTIACHICAGO @gmail.com. In the subject line, indicate Midwest Conference and put your name. And then in the body of the email, indicate that you would like to attend by Zoom or if you happen to be close by and want to attend. I think there is a conference fee for live attendance. If you are in the Chicago area, something like $35 or $40, that's probably covering whatever meals or what other kinds of things that they're doing, you know, in person, rentals, that kind of thing. And that's it. But that is, again, February 10th through the 12th, with most of the activities occurring on Saturday, and just do that. And I believe Ken Kaiser is the one who is looking at those emails and then making sure that people get assigned and get the Zoom link.
Cool. Should be very interesting, I think. Let's see if I can share.
Should be fascinating getting some of that history. And, of course, Marvin will be aware that GARD has been heavily involved with Marilyn Kulicki in putting together you know, a history that I think they're hoping to publish this summer or sometime. And they probably will have something to say about that period of time along with the other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so
and I was just going to...
The process of the birth of the revelation, you know, how it came about, the people involved, mm-hmm. the groups, how they functioned, and just the integrity of the process. Go ahead, Paula.
Well, no, and it's free for Zoom attendance, too. And
it is.
So,
it's free for Zoom attendance.
What?
There's no cost. It's free for Zoom attendance. That's
anybody can attend
by Zoom. There's no charge for Zoom attendance. Free.
So we should reiterate that we are deferring in deference to this wonderful conference that's coming up next weekend. We won't be doing the Cosmic Citizen on the 11th. Mm-hmm. And I will put all the information up on the blurb so people can look it up. And when they, you know, if they look for the Cosmic Citizen at Blog Talk Radio, then they'll find all the pertinent, relevant information to join that conference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we will be back in 2 weeks on the 18th and look forward to continuing with the mystery of God then.
Yeah, the mystery of God. What a great section that will be.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to that. And then the one after that is personality of the Universal Father. I mean, these papers are so incredible and so amazing. And,
yeah.
I highly recommend anybody who hasn't read all five together to do that at some point and read the whole book. You know, that's like, Andre, you call it our Hajj. I just think that's so apropos.
Yeah, it's the Hajj. It's our pilgrimage for your Rancho book readers. Do one sequential reading. Skip around all you want while you're doing it, but come back to where you left off. You know, in your sequential reading, there's something about that upload, that continuous upload, that somehow gives our thought adjuster, in my experience, something different to work with.
Yeah.
When we do it that way, it somehow orders it in the mind the way they intend to order in the mind. And if you don't believe that, read paper 19, section 1. That's some of the justification for thinking that.
Yeah.
Well, it gives you a whole sense of the trajectory of the revelation, you know, and how it moves, you know, moves us in a journey, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
When you read when you read it sequentially,
Yes.
Yeah.
It opens up and unfolds, layer by layer, just piece by piece.
Mm-hmm.
Everything
yeah.
starts to make so much sense, and I agree with you, Andre. I don't think we can divorce ourselves from what it's taught us. It's just in there now, you know. It's not going anywhere. It's part and parcel of who we are and how we think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, well, it's a good time to say thank you to all of our listeners. Really love you guys. Love seeing you every week on the board. Love your thoughts. It's really just wonderful. And to John, who also calls in and listens, thank you, John. And to Vaughn, we haven't seen Vaughn in a couple weeks. I don't know where he's been, but we should probably reach out. And Pam Gina and Isadora, thank you, girls. And love you all, and thank you to all of our listeners weekly who listen on the archive. We really appreciate it. That's what we do it for. Mm-hmm. We hope you find value in it. We sure do.
Yeah, love you all. So
so
we'll see you all in a couple of weeks, right?
In a couple of weeks, yep.
Yep.
And until then.
See you on the 18th.
All right.
Yep.
Okay, until then.
Bye for now.
Love you.
Good to be with you guys.
Love you too.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, We hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.